In 1978, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in the Marquette case to deregulate credit card interest rates. Practically speaking, a carte blanche that enabled credit card companies to set up in states, South Dakota, Delaware, et al., willing to allow full freedom. 2 years later, President Carter signed the Deposit Institutions Deregulation Act, voiding the 5% limitation on the interest rate that banks and savings institutions could pay, likewise a precondition for future innovations. In 1984, the Bank Holding Company Act was relaxed to allow banks to hold entire companies as if they were a portfolio of investments, even if they didn't perform banking-related functions. Permissiveness only broadened in the 1990s. In 1996, the U.S. Supreme Court held in the Barnett Bank case that banks could sell insurance. A second ruling that year, in Smiley v. Citibank, allowed credit card issuers to charge any fees, penalties for the most part, permitted by the states in which they were based. Within a few years, fees would begin to multiply like rabbits. In 1997, banks were allowed to buy securities firms. In 1999, after the Federal Reserve Board had already approved a merger between Citigroup and Travelers, a major insurance company, the policy of allowing such mergers belatedly became official with the enactment of the Financial Services Modernization Act. That same far-reaching statute also repealed the Bank Holding Company Act of 1957, establishing a new category of financial holding companies, FHCs. These could not only hold banks, securities firms, and insurance companies under one umbrella, but were also permitted to include non-financial enterprises. The 1995 to 2000 period had already seen a stunning crescendo of bank mergers, 11,100. Within a year after passage of the financial services mega deregulation, 500 new FHCs were created. This sequence, a powerful facilitator of the 1997 to 2000 stock market bubble, simultaneously gave the financial services industry essential wherewithal to consolidate its gains in share of GDP and soon to displace the toppled technology sector as the leader in U.S. stock market capitalization. For all that financiers lost huge sums of paper wealth in 2001 and 2002, the underlying realignment of the U.S. economy remained in place. Portions of the 1990s deregulation, it should be noted, rested on sound enough logic. Chairman Greenspan and others believed that the United States, handicapped by an old state-by-state banking structure rooted in Jeffersonian suspicions, required instead a phalanx of U.S. superbanks able to leapfrog state lines and abandon the 1930s ordered separation of banking, investment, and insurance in order to compete with giant financial conglomerates in the Japanese, British, French, Swiss, and German mold. By 2003, three of the world's top 10 banks were indeed American, up from none in 1988. The downside, unfortunately, was institutional hubris. Three U.S. banks became superbanks: Citigroup, the world's biggest, and the Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase, ranked further down. Compared to their predecessors of the 1980s, these institutions were powerhouses, Goliaths with units that ran the gamut from insurance and merchant banking to consumer credit. However, as these giants flexed their new muscles, the public interest was often squeezed. Witness the record of Citigroup. In late 1990, Citigroup was close to insolvency because of bad real estate and foreign loans. However, Citigroup's size made it essential to any global strategy for U.S. banking, and Federal Reserve officials helped to arrange a cash infusion and rescue by Saudi Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal. By 2004, the firm's new global primacy was matched by its lead in transgressions and large government fines. Name any scandal of the last decade: Enron, WorldCom, Parmalat, biased stock research, and Citigroup's name will crop up, concluded the Times of London. Conspicuous abuses outside the United States included a 2004 effort to rig the European bond market and a wayward private client operation in Tokyo that was shut down the same year by the Japanese government. Within the United States, the bank's most notable chastisements included $215 million to settle Federal Trade Commission charges of applying predatory lending techniques to poor and unsophisticated borrowers, along with a $2 billion fine for allegedly colluding with Enron in defrauding investors. As part of Citigroup's agreement to pay the $2 billion, however, the company was allowed to deny the wrongdoing alleged. Despite their size, such fines resembled hypothetically giving John D. Rockefeller a mere $50 million fine back in 1905, say, without making him admit the misbehavior of Standard Oil. No behavior would change. Just as in oil's emerging years, so much money was moving around within the swelling financial sector. Citigroup's revenues in 2004 topped $86 billion, that the practical effect of seemingly huge fines was hard to measure.